Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Monday, June 14th. Thank you for joining us. I'm April Austin.
And I'm Ken Kaplan.
Darnella Frazier did not set out to become a citizen journalist. Still, the Pulitzer Prize Committee, which honors exceptional journalism, on Friday awarded the Minneapolis teenager a special citation. It recognized Ms. Frazier for courageously recording the murder of George Floyd, a video that spurred protests against police brutality around the world, highlighting the crucial role of citizens in journalists' quest for truth and justice. Honoring her bravery and determination is important. Her 10-minute video, which has been called one of the most important civil rights documents in a generation, helped make possible the rare conviction of a police officer in the killing of a Black person. But what has largely been ignored in the excitement over the award, which carries a $15,000 prize, is the ongoing cost to Ms. Frazier's peace of mind. She has consistently avoided giving interviews, which could cause her to relive the trauma of Mr. Floyd's death. To escape reporters, her family has been forced to move from hotel to hotel. The mainstream press has not always treated people of color with respect or empathy. So it's not surprising that some communities distrust reporters in the same way they distrust law enforcement. The advent of cell phones and the ability to record videos has placed the tools of journalism into the hands of people who have often been misrepresented and disbelieved. Mickey Kendall, a Black journalist, points out that in Ms. Frazier's case, the Pulitzer Committee failed to seize a historic moment to expand journalism's highest prize to include new voices. She wrote in an opinion piece on CNN.com, "A better recognition for Frazier's work would have been inclusion in an existing category or the creation of or call for a new category honoring citizen journalism." Ms. Frazier's video brought racism and injustice to light. "The world needed to see what I was seeing," she has said. Her motivation goes to the heart of what good journalism does. Now, today's stories. Our first story, President Joe Biden's approach to international alliances and shared values has helped inject a renewed sense of purpose into NATO. But could its focus become too diffuse?
Former President Donald Trump had suggested that NATO was obsolete, leaving alliance officials and U.S. allies to worry he could pull the plug at any moment. But President Joe Biden, who brought his commitment to alliances to the NATO summit Monday, along with his conviction that democracies are best suited to meet the 21st century's challenges, went a good way toward addressing those insecurities. As NATO ends its Afghanistan mission in September, the transatlantic alliance is deriving renewed purpose from new challenges: an aggressive Russia, instability around the Mediterranean, a rising China, and 21st century threats, including cybersecurity and faltering democratic governance. Ian Lesser, executive director of the German Marshall Fund's Brussels office, puts it this way: "There's no question that the atmosphere of this summit is very positive and marks a shift very much appreciated in Europe. The shift on display is one of style, but there is substance to the change as well." At the same time, an expanded to-do list has some experts worried the alliance is at risk of losing its focus. Says Andrea Kendall Taylor at the Center for a New American Security in Washington, "It's not so much a question now of NATO's relevance, but of NATO being drawn in too many directions." This story was reported by Howard LaFranchi in Brussels for The Monitor.
Russia and the United States are at a nadir in their relations. Russians hope that Wednesday's summit between the country's leaders will establish a baseline understanding of each other's red lines.
The summit between U.S. President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin in Geneva on Wednesday has the potential to either arrest or accelerate the decline in what the Kremlin still regards as Russia's most important bilateral relationship. In Moscow, there is a widespread sense of frustration over the acrimonious downward spiral that has smothered what was once a fairly robust dialogue, gutted the Cold War-era system of arms control treaties, and left the embassies of both countries without ambassadors. That this summit is happening at all is a profoundly hopeful sign. Mr. Biden suggested it in an April phone conversation with Mr. Putin after relations arguably reached an all-time low when the U.S. president said he thought the Kremlin leader is a killer and both sides withdrew their ambassadors for extended consultations. But progress is apt to be modest. There are a lot of emotions in play. People have all kinds of conflicting expectations, and it's not likely anyone will feel satisfied, says Fyodor Lukyanov, editor of a Moscow-based foreign policy journal. Nobody should expect any breakthroughs or grand bargains. In my view, the summit will be successful if we start shaping the framework for a new confrontation. This story was reported by Fred Ware in Moscow for The Monitor.
Will the killing of a Muslim family in a hit-and-run incident finally force Canada to face up to its darker side and take steps to eradicate Islamophobia?
The killing of four members of the Afzal family in London, Ontario, on June 6th, when a young man ran them over with his truck because they were Muslim, has stirred Canadians to take a hard look at Islamophobia in their midst. Over the weekend, thousands took to the streets to commemorate the family and take a stand against the hate that took their lives. The display of support has been overwhelming at the grassroots, says Munir El-Qasim, imam of the Islamic Center of Southwest Ontario. It's getting to the point where people say, enough is enough. Javid Sukera, chair of the London Police Services Board, says the narrative of Canada as a multicultural country of welcome is such a comfortable one for Canadians that it makes it hard to see the hate below the surface. This whole year for me has been a lot of cycling between hope and despair, he says. I hope this will be a reckoning, a chance to look in the mirror and stop the denialism and avoidance. But I also know that Canada is going to start this a couple of steps behind where we needed to be in the first place. This story was reported by Sarah Miller-Yana in London and Ryan Yu in Toronto for The Monitor.
In a mirror of the U.S. as a whole, America's largest Protestant denomination is a house divided on issues of race, gender, and politics. Can it continue to stand?
A flock of 16,000-plus Southern Baptist Convention members has congregated in Nashville, Tennessee, for the denomination's annual summit, preparing to decide its future. From his office in Arlington, Texas, the Reverend Dwight McKissick and half a dozen other Black pastors will watch for two specific outcomes. If the Southern Baptist Convention rescinds a 2019 resolution tepidly approving critical race theory as an analytical tool, or if one of the two most conservative candidates in this year's election wins, his church will leave the denomination. I see them turning back the clock on race, and that is a line in the sand for me, says Mr. McKissick. For decades, the Southern Baptist Convention has united around a commitment to scriptural authority and a willingness to oppose secular culture. But the past 10 years have ushered in a revolution for LGBTQ rights, the advent of Black Lives Matter, and the divisive term of President Donald Trump. This new, more polarized America has made it harder to stay united around doctrine alone. This is a bit of an identity crisis moment for the SBC and white evangelical Christianity more generally, says Jamar Tisby, church historian and CEO of The Witness, a Black Christian collective. This story was reported by Noah Robertson in Alabama for The Monitor.
Growing interest in historic urban sites of Black history is a corrective to their displacement by urban redevelopment. These tours also highlight the resilience of Black communities in the past.
In cities across the United States, walking tours focused on Black history are taking that history out of books and archives and putting it into real life. They are also putting tangible context to historically Black neighborhoods that have changed, sometimes naturally, sometimes forcibly, over the years. For Samson Levingston, an interest in oft-forgotten Black history in Indianapolis was the touchstone for starting his own walking tour there last year. A summer of protests against racial injustice catalyzed his desire to showcase how Black communities flourished in the past and what remains of those communities today after decades of urban churn. Like tour leaders in other cities, from Boston to New York to Philadelphia, he points out what's gone, the buildings and their inhabitants, while also highlighting what remains, whether through historic preservation or sheer perseverance. Taking history out of the classroom, says Christine Anderson, an associate history professor at Xavier University, can give people back their history, especially when you're talking about underserved or marginalized communities. This story was reported by Nick Roll in Indianapolis for The Monitor.
Now, commentary from The Monitor's editorial board on the election of Naftali Bennett as Israel's new prime minister. The opening speech of a newly elected leader can not only set a new tone for a democracy, it can also help to heal its broken politics. On Sunday, for example, when Israel's lawmakers chose Naftali Bennett as the new prime minister, his talk was one of gratitude and generosity, just the necessary antidotes for years of hate-driven divisions within Israeli society. Mr. Bennett began with a prayer of thanksgiving and then proceeded to praise the very person that he and his coalition partners so badly wanted to oust as prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Expressing gratitude is a fundamental principle in Judaism, he reminded Jewish Israelis, and then thanked Mr. Netanyahu for his years of service. And he said this even after Mr. Netanyahu vowed to bring down the new government, and his supporters heckled the new prime minister in parliament. That turn-the-other-cheek aspect of the speech may seem unusual in politics, which often focus on a person over deeper social trends. But as the founding editor of the Times of Israel, David Horovitz, wrote, the new coalition can only be a government of national healing. Otherwise, it will not be a government at all. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thanks for starting your week with us. Come back tomorrow for a look at New York's mayoral race and what it might signal about the 2022 midterms. In today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective, our contributor shares how recognizing that we're all part of God's universal family empowers us to build bridges and make meaningful connections wherever we may be. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton and Tara Adhikari.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2021.